From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in East Oakland.
Cleveland Heights.
I live in Adams Point.
West Oakland.
I live in San Leandro now.
Up Beach.
Coming up, a creek that divides two cities worries neighbors this El Nino season.
If the Palo Alto side is higher than East Palo Alto side, that means that East Palo Alto will always flood, and Palo Alto will never flood.
Then we'll get to the bottom of a mystery found in San Francisco intersections.
And I, like many other people, have wondered, what the hell's underneath those brick circles?
And we'll meet shadow puppet master Larry Reed.
I think shadows in particular have a different impact than anything else does, because it hits you in that same place in the back of your head that dreams come from.
Water, water everywhere. And puppets, today on Cross Currents. El Nino is upon us. In the first week of January, the Bay Area got more rain in 2 days than it did in the previous three Januaries combined. But too much rain all at once can be a dangerous thing. It can cause erosion, mudslides, and flooding. During the last El Nino in 1998, storms caused over $500 million of damage. 17 people died. 35 counties were declared federal disaster areas. East Palo Alto was hit especially hard. The San Francisquito Creek flooded after a week of heavy rain in February and damaged 1,700 homes. Now, 18 years later, residents are worried the same thing could happen again. KALW's Angela Johnston has the story.
Spencina Sims remembers the 98 flood like it was yesterday.
It was a lot of rain.
Her backyard borders the San Francisquito Creek in East Palo Alto. She and her husband, Curtis, have lived in this house for 50 years. Curtis says he was watching television when he got a call from his neighbor asking if they were going to evacuate. He was surprised.
Until I went to the patio and water was almost, you know, like I said, coming through the bottom of the patio door. So that's when we left.
As they scrambled to leave, firemen and police officers began driving around in cars and boats, speaking through megaphones, urging people to evacuate.
And we was out of our house for 3 months.
They moved in with a relative a few blocks away. They didn't have flood insurance, so they had to pay most of the repair bills themselves, thousands of dollars, before they could move back home. Then, in 2012, the creek overflowed again. This time, it only flooded their garage.
And we had water, I mean, up to almost our knees when we got in the car to leave here.
Curtis takes me out into the backyard to show me signs of the previous floods. He points to a fence they built after the 1998 flood. The creek is right on the other side. He unlocks the gate and we walk out onto the creek's levee. It's basically just a raised pile of gravel and dirt. The bottom foot of the fence is coated with a fine layer of dry mud. He says it's left over from 2012.
See that mud?
Yeah.
That tell you how high the water come up on the fence. And over there, the most of the water, it come over there, but it spread it across this whole area.
Curtis hopes that if the creek overflows this year, it'll be different. That his neighborhood will be protected by something called a sandbag burrito. Yes, a sandbag burrito.
Well, basically, it's taking sand, either in sandbags or sand-free sand, and wrapping it in concrete.
That's Len Matterman. He's the executive director of the San Francisquito Creek Joint Powers Authority. The sandbag burritos are actually a well-known piece of infrastructure in the engineering world. And on the outside, they don't look much like actual burritos, just long cement mounds. It's the wrapping process that gives them their names. The sand is like the rice and beans. They get wrapped tightly in a tarp, the tortilla. And then that gets wrapped again in cement, the foil. Their purpose?
To raise the elevation of the levee to slightly more than match what's on the Palo Alto side.
The San Francisquito Creek runs through the towns of Palo Alto, East Palo Alto, and Menlo Park. It also divides two counties. After the 1998 flood, they all got together to try to restore the creek, to make sure the same thing didn't happen again. The idea, Matterman said, was to transform the creek into something that people could be proud of, not afraid of. But that's easier said than done.
This creek is the county line. It's also the dividing line between cities. It's very difficult to work on a creek that is a county line and a city line because you have different players that have different interests, and there's no way to fix half of it.
The sandbag burritos were constructed last month in preparation for this year's El Nino. They're only temporary, though. They'll last about 4 or 5 years before they start to rot and disintegrate from within. The real fix hasn't happened yet, to completely rebuild the levee. Make it wider, higher, and stronger to prevent flooding, even in the worst of storms.
This whole community here is below sea level. And if water overtops, and you think about it, it basically just starts filling up behind the levee. And so it doesn't have a way to drain to the bay. It's kind of like a bathtub, right? It just starts filling up. And that's what really worries us.
It's especially worrisome because one side of the creek is more vulnerable than the other. Matterman and I are standing on the bank of the creek in East Palo Alto. And just feet away, right in front of us, is the city of Palo Alto, a completely different city with a different government, a university, an airport, the 101 freeway. And Palo Alto is not below sea level. It's also one of the wealthiest cities in the Bay Area. East Palo Alto is one of the poorest. And most of the 5,000 or so homes in the creek's floodplain are in East Palo Alto.
There's definitely property damage and life safety issues in Palo Alto. But in terms of life safety, this is the really critical area right here.
Where we're standing, where Spencina and Curtis Sims live. And if the Palo Alto side of the creek is built even just an inch higher, East Palo Alto will always flood. That's why it was important to build the sandbag burritos the exact same height on both sides. This year's El Nino is predicted to be stronger than the one in 1998, the one that displaced Spencina and Curtis Sims and so many others from their homes. I ask Matterman if the temporary sandbag burritos will protect people from the same kind of flood damage.
This will protect people from what we saw 3 years ago, but not what we saw 17 years ago.
Only a new, rebuilt levee will stop that type of flooding. The permanent fix was supposed to be finished last year, but because of the mix of cities, counties, and organizations involved, they haven't even started. The Joint Powers Authority is still trying to get all the necessary permits. But at least both sides of the creek are talking.
It's extremely difficult, but it's also very refreshing to see them all work together.
Dennis Parker lives just down the street from the Sims in East Palo Alto. He moved here in 1999, the year after the last big flood. And he knows that the sandbag burritos won't work as well as the permanent fix. His house doesn't back up along the creek, but he's still preparing his family and his neighborhood for a major flood.
Some people make their own emergency kits, but you can also buy them.
He became a leader of his community emergency response team. He learned how to operate a ham radio and keeps emergency kits in his two cars and another one in his garage.
It's got some drinking water. It's got a flashlight. It's got a first aid kit.
Parker says he's happy there's been some creek restoration work this year, and he thinks the sandbag burritos are a good sign. He's getting ready for the worst, but it's been difficult to convince his neighbors to do the same.
But, you know, people are just apathetic in general. They really don't want to think about, well, some of it is apathy and some of it is denial. Oh, it's not really going to rain that hard.
At an El Nino prep meeting a few months ago, only a dozen or so residents came out. This upsets Parker. He says it might be because of a language or cultural barrier. According to the last census, East Palo Alto is over 60% Latino. Or maybe, he says, it's because East Palo Alto doesn't have its own local paper. Whatever the cause, it makes him worried. Worried about how people are going to know something is wrong.
It's like, how do you really know when it's time to get out of here?
A new flood warning app created by Len Matterman and the Joint Powers Authority can help, but you need internet or cell phone access to use it. I asked Spencina and Curtis Sims if they've signed up. They don't use the internet, they told me. They'll get live updates from friends and family.
You ain't got to worry about it, so we be aware. We'll know it when it happens.
The Joint Powers Authority hopes to get all of the permits to begin reconstructing the levee in March. Until then, people like the Sims are relying on their neighbors and the sandbag burritos. In East Palo Alto, I'm Angela Johnston for Cross Currents.
For more information about El Nino and to see if your home is in a floodplain, go to KALW.org and click on Cross Currents. Cross Currents. I'm Henat Baba. People have been trying to protect their cities from natural disasters for about as long as those cities have existed. Take San Francisco. The 1906 earthquake and fire was the most devastating disaster in the city's history. Afterwards, the fire department developed a unique system to try to prevent that kind of destruction from ever happening again. And though you may not realize it, you can see evidence of that system in today's city streets. KALW's Audrey Dilling shows us where to look.
Oh, wow, there it is. There it is. We have a winner.
Hava Cronenberg is on a manhole hunt.
I'm pretty surprised we found that. I thought it was looking pretty bad.
Cronenberg is a volunteer helping a local artist with a project. She's biking around the city with her partner for the day, Lucas Keining, who's visiting from Holland. They've got a list of the potential locations of a specific kind of manhole. Their assignment is to find as many of these manholes as they can, take a picture, and grab the GPS coordinates using a smartphone app.
What do they call a manhole in Holland?
A put deksel, or a riool deksel,
I think. What does that translate to?
So sewer lid, I guess, yeah. But we don't talk about them that much, I guess. It's not like the...
common.
The most interesting thing
it's
in all.
It's not like they're the subject of radio stories.
No, maybe not, no.
But these sewer lids are totally radio worthy. You might have even seen them around San Francisco. They look just like any other manhole, but these ones are each surrounded by a ring of bricks about 20 feet across.
A lot of people have noticed the brick circles around San Francisco.
That's San Francisco artist Scott Kildall. He's the one who sent Cronenberg and Keining out on their mission. Kildall is working on a project to make people more aware of city infrastructure. As far as he knows, no one has ever created a complete map of all these brick rings. So that's part of his project.
And then once you point them out to him, you can't not see them in San Francisco. Everywhere you look seems to be these brick circles. And I, like many other people, have wondered, what the hell is underneath those brick circles?
So what the hell is under there? I'll let this guy answer that.
Could you go ahead and introduce yourself?
Assistant Deputy Chief Ken Lombardi with the San Francisco Fire Department.
And what are we looking at right now? What's that brick ring?
Right now you're looking at a cistern, and it's a concrete vault underneath the ground.
Beneath the lid is a dark pool of water.
This is our emergency water supply. As long as we pull that manhole cover, there'll be 75,000 gallons of water there for us.
The cisterns are totally unconnected from the rest of the water system. There are no pipes running in or out. Almost 200 of them are scattered around San Francisco. And Lombardi says this is the only city that has them. To understand why, we need to go back to the gold rush. Can I get some period music? Excellent.
Well, in those days, San Francisco had several problems.
That's Robert Graysmith. He wrote a book called Black Fire, which is about six major fires that ravaged San Francisco between 1849 and 1851. And he's right. Back then, the city had problems. For starters, it was basically a tinderbox. The buildings were all made of wood, old boat parts, canvas, whatever was lying around. There was also no plumbing and no official fire department. Instead, troops of volunteer firefighters formed.
If you were a fireman, you were the elite, because these volunteers were, they dressed, they were handsome, sexy. They had tight leggings and shiny boots and red jackets, but they risked their lives and they paid for their own uniforms, the upkeep of the engines, they paid for the engines. They did everything themselves.
They were also kind of the broiest bros in Brotown. They would race to be the first to the fire and sometimes get in fistfights along the way, which sounds even crazier when you understand just how hard it was to get anywhere at the time. What were some of the things they were up against? I primarily want to talk about the mud. I want to make sure we talk about the mud.
That's funny. Yeah, my editor, everybody loves that part. The street, you literally, to try to cross the street back in 1850, you were taking your life in your hands. There have been scenes where a guy's driving his wagon with all the horses, and the whole thing gets sucked right down. He's still cracking the whip. And literally, they would have to lasso people and pull them onto the planks built along the road.
Let's just say urban planning wasn't the city's strong suit. And remember, there's no plumbing. So the volunteers had to haul 2,000-pound water tanks through these muddy streets and then fight a raging fire.
Pumping the water was so difficult, you could break an arm, and people did.
And then, after all that work, sometimes the water tank would run dry before the fire went out. So some of the fire chiefs got together and begged the city for help. They asked for underground water storage tanks to be built around San Francisco, and the city built about a dozen, the first San Francisco cisterns. The fire epidemic stopped after 1851, and by the late 1860s, San Francisco had both an official fire department and underground plumbing. The city kept some of the cisterns full, but basically, they were old news.
They were a laughingstock of the city.
That's San Francisco artist Scott Kildall again.
People were wondering, why are we spending any money filling up these banks of water that we're never going to use? And then lo and behold, when the 1906 earthquake struck,
fires broke out and the water mains burst.
And so the fire department couldn't put out the actual fires all over the city. And it was at that point that they tapped into these old cisterns that they had been diligently filling up every year and put out some of the fires in Telegraph Hill and Rincon Hill and helped save vital portions of the city.
Despite these few victories, the 1906 fire raged for 3 days, destroying huge portions of the city. Later, a national fire board declared that if enough water had been available, it most likely could have been put out in the first day. So in 1908, the city passed a $5 million bond to fund a backup water supply system, including separate pipes for fighting fires and about 150 new cisterns. These are all still up and running today, but
the reality is that most people don't actually notice the cisterns until you point them out to them.
And that's what Kildall's trying to do with his mapping project, point them out.
What I hope people take away from the Waterworks project is that there's an amazing circulatory system that lives underneath our feet. And it's something that I think we don't think about very often, that we take for granted. The water just flows when we turn on the tap.
He's got us going a lot of places.
With help from volunteers like Lucas Kining and Hava Cronenberg, Kildall has made an illustrated map of about 120 San Francisco cisterns. It's his way of reminding us to pay attention to the stories underneath our feet.
That's part of being a cistern detective.
Yeah, come on, brothers and cisterns, yeah.
For Cross Currents, I'm Audrey Dillon.
To find that map of San Francisco cisterns, head to KALW.org and click on Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. Larry Reed is a master of shadow puppetry. He learned the craft the traditional way in Bali in the 1970s. Since then, his company, Shadowlight Productions, has developed its own style, using cinematic elements and contemporary theater and dance styles to modernize the work and make it accessible to wider audiences. KALW's Jen Chien spoke with Reed about collaborating with artists from other cultures to create theater that fosters understanding between all people.
When and how did you first get into shadow puppetry, shadow theater?
I was a student at the Art Institute.
Here in San Francisco.
And I had been a Peace Corps theater director in Costa Rica.
And when was this?
That was in the 60s. And I came from there to San Francisco. And I thought that film would be easier to do than theater. So I enrolled in the Art Institute as a film student. And I was interested in masks and stuff like that. People kept saying we should go to Bali, and I kept resisting. But finally, I got a camera, and I went to Bali, and the camera got stolen. So I had to change my plan a little bit.
You couldn't make a film.
So I started out wanting to learn mask dancing, and they said, okay, first learn the music. But I did. I actually ended up not learning it right then, but coming back to San Francisco, there was a school of Asian music and dance at the time. And got involved with that. Through that, started learning music, started learning dance, and then shadow theater.
And did you start learning the Balinese music immediately? Or lots of...
Well, yes. And I say that kind of in a funny way, because at that time there was no Balinese gamelan here.
Mm-hmm.
There was a Javanese gamelan. Anyway, it evolved.
Uh-huh.
This was an amazing school. There were 50 master musician teachers and about 200-something students. It traveled up and down the West Coast following the school wherever it found a place to be for the summer. So, but I hadn't started yet. So with this guy, I said, I really want to learn this, because to me it was the original screenplay.
Uh-huh.
It was like a movie. Literally a screenplay. And he said, well, I'm studying in the U.S. right now, so why don't you go to my house and stay in my room and study with my father? And that was the beginning of a, 30 or 40 year relationship. And for the next 20 years, I was going back to that same porch and studying with this man and learning the music.
And so then when did you start your company, Shadowlight Productions?
In the 90s, in 90, actually. So my idea was to start a company and be able to do Balinese wayang while we created bigger projects.
Meaning doing the traditional form, but also kind of branching out and making your own stuff.
Yeah, because I had come to a certain realization, first of all, that I'd gotten to a point having kids and all of that, that I wasn't going to be able to spend extended times in Bali anymore.
Uh-huh.
That I'd learned everything I was able to learn. And that, in fact, not everybody in the world is interested in Balinese shadow theater. But everybody is interested in their own culture. And I think shadows in particular have a different impact than anything else does.
So over the years, you have been experimenting with bringing modern theatrical techniques into shadow theater, kind of making your own way through using the traditional form. Tell me about some of the things that you've done to sort of hybridize.
Well, let me start with saying that this is not like regular theater. We use single point light sources.
Can you explain what that looks like behind the screen for people?
Yeah, there's a light source of some sort, and we've used several different kinds. But the smaller the filament, the more single point the light source is. And that means you get a shadow with sharp edges at a certain point. So it's basically a projector is only sharp when it's at the screen. But with these lights, you can be at a certain distance from the light, and everything from there on will be sharp. So that allows us to have puppets interacting with actors wearing masks of the same character or a different character. And then by using two or three lights or more, we can change from one light to another, and kind of magically we're in a new place.
I'm speaking with shadow theater artist Larry Reed, founder and director of Shadowlight Productions. Your new piece, Feathers of Fire, is a collaboration with the filmmaker and visual artist Hamid Rahmanian, and it's based on the great thousand-year-old Persian epic, the Shahnameh, the Book of Kings. Tell me the story of the Shahnameh.
Well, we're doing the very first episode in the book, which is...
Which is 60,000 verses.
Something
right?
Like that,
It's a very big story.
This is the story of the birth of the hero, but it's a prequel, really, to the whole thing. And it's a story of kings. So there's a general who's working for the king, and he falls in love with a woman of the court. And they have a child, and the child turns out to be strange-looking, with white hair, looking like an old man. He doesn't want anybody to see it. How could this come from me, he says, So he takes it to the mountains and leaves it behind. And a magical bird, like a giant eagle, finds it and brings it up to feed the babies. But the babies get along with the bird, and so she raises him along with her own eagle children.
What kinds of things have you learned from studying and practicing this art form that you apply to your regular life?
I think I've learned an appreciation of mythology, and it's expanded, I think, an ability to understand all sorts of things, because it takes you outside of your normal world. And it's kind of like, I like to think of, you know, we all have dreams, and mythology is a public dream.
That was shadow puppet master Larry Reed speaking with KLW's Jen Chien. Reed and his company present a new work based on a Persian tale, Feathers of Fire, starting this Saturday and running through Monday, and that's at the Cowell Theater in Fort Mason. For more information, go to KALW.org and click on Cross Currents. And while you're online, why not subscribe to our podcast? KLW has a new podcast page where you can sign up to hear all your favorite programs on demand. Take a look and tell us what you think. We love hearing from you. Because of you, we can proudly say we're listener-supported public radio. Our team includes Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Angela Johnston, Ted Muldoon, Truk Nguyen, Edwin Okongo, Colin Peden, James Rollins, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. The line producer was Jeremy Dalmas. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This music is by San Francisco band Manos Lindas. They call their sound face-melting music. Manos Lindas plays at Hotel Utah on Saturday night. Show starts at 9 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.